Hello, friend. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast, and I hope you hear something truly, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, something that edifies, equips, enlightens, encourages, and then gently but firmly gets you out there into the marketplace of ideas. I so appreciate your taking the time to listen. But before you start the broadcast, let me just take a moment and explain that this month's truth tool is called SEEK, S-E-E-K, written by my friend David Robertson, my favorite Scottish apologist who is currently serving the Lord in Australia. He comes and visits with us once a month. And he wrote a book called Ask, and now he's written a follow-up book called Seek, Real Word Answers to Real World Questions. And so he literally goes through a whole series of questions like, is there ever a good lie? Or does the Bible have mistakes? Or what does the Bible say about climate change? Or what's the difference between capitalism and communism? And the list goes on and on and on. So it is a fabulous reference book that I know you're going to want to put in your legacy library. So if you'd like a copy of Seek, and we are listener-supported radio, I'd love to send one to you when you give a gift of any amount to support In the Market with Janet Parshall. Simply call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, and offer a gift of any amount. We'll send you a copy of David's book, Seek. Or if you'd rather do it online, go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page. There's the cover. It has a brain on the cover, so you can't miss it. Click on the cover of the book, make your gift right through the website, and we'll send you a copy of Seek by David Robertson. Great tool to have, one of those important little volumes in your ready reference library, and I know you're going to be blessed. By the way, when you're on the website, you might want to consider being a Parshall partner. Those are people who give every single month at a level of their own choosing. They always get whatever the truth tool is that particular month. And in addition to that, they get a newsletter that contains an audio piece from me as well. So Parshall partner or just this month's truth tool, either way, it helps us financially to keep moving forward. 877-JANET-58, 877-JANET-58, or online at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Now please, enjoy the broadcast.
Here are some of the news headlines we're watching.
By the time the conference was over, the president won a pledge.
So are Americans worshiping government over God?
An extremely rare safety move by a nation.
17 years the Palestinians and Israelis negotiated.
Hi, friends. Welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall. What a weekend. Rocket sirens and booms were heard across Israel early Sunday morning after Iran launched an unprecedented wide-scale aerial assault that threatened to push the Middle East to the brink of a regional war. Israel's military says it intercepted the vast majority of more than 300 Iranian attack drones and missiles. A statement from the IDF said a few impacts were identified, among them at a military base in the south of the country with minor damage to infrastructure. And apparently fighter jets also shot down dozens of cruise missiles and drones. Now, in the meantime, of course, because Iran had this unprecedented attack against Israel, now Israel has said they are going to respond. And in the meantime, our president is weighing in saying, no, that shouldn't be done. You've got people from the UN Security Council who are also saying, no, it shouldn't be done. But then you have several lawmakers here in the United States that are saying, of course, the only language Iran will understand is a response. If they send this unprecedented hail of fire that came down on Israel early Sunday morning, and Israel doesn't do anything except intercept, thank you, God, for David Sling and the Iron Dome, aren't those great names for defense mechanisms? They were very effective, did their job wonderfully, by the way. So Israel just sits and waits for the next assault? I don't know. That's why you and I need to be praying for those in authority. But I'm going to go to my friend Chris Mitchell, who was there. I was praying for him over the weekend, because while he is the bureau chief for the Middle East for CBN News, it didn't mean that he was out of harm's way. And yet, his superb reporting continued. Have a listen.
In its first direct strike by Iran against Israel, Iran attacked with more than 300 drones, cruise, and ballistic missiles. It brought a 45-year shadow war into the light. The difference between Iran and Israel's capabilities on stark display, with reports that about half of the projectiles either failed on launch or crashed before reaching their targets. The vast majority of the rest were destroyed by Israel and its partners, including the U.S., France, Britain, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. the 99% interception rate described as a spectacular military achievement. Stunning video showed some missiles being shot down over Jerusalem. On Sunday, Israel's war cabinet met to decide how to respond. Benny Gantz said Israel will respond when the time is right, and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant urged an international coalition against Iran. After the attack, President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talked by phone. Biden reportedly told Netanyahu, "You got a win, take a win," and urged him to carefully think through the consequences of any retaliation. He also said the U.S. won't participate in any strike against Iran.
The president's been very clear. We don't seek a war with Iran. We're not looking for escalation here. We will continue to help Israel defend itself.
Yet some U.S. lawmakers say the U.S. should support an Israeli retaliatory strike.
I think a proportionate response here. I think one option would be to take out the facilities where these drones and rockets came from and also destroy the manufacturing facilities that build the drones and rockets.
We need to stand with Israel. Israel's not at war with Hamas or Hezbollah or Yemen. Those are all surrogates for Iran. Those are, they're prostitutes. The pimp is Iran. Israel is at war with Iran. Iran hates Americans. Iran hates Jews. Iran wants to kill Americans and Jews.
Former Israeli ambassador to the UN and Knesset member Danny Danone told CBN News he believes a great defense is not enough.
We have to show also our offensive capabilities in order to create deterrence in the region against Iran. They attacked a sovereign country with 300 rockets, missiles, and UAVs, and we cannot sit idly by. And my position is that we have to hit them hard to teach them a lesson that they will not do it again.
While the Israelis and their partners praise the air defense, some also point to the power of prayer in protecting the Jewish state.
No, I want to thank all those who pray for us and stand with us. I think last night what we saw was the hand of God protecting Israel as well.
CBN's Chuck Holton shared how he hosted a live report on YouTube in the minutes after the attack started.
As the rockets and drones were still flying toward Israel, so before we knew what would actually take place, we had 40,000 people online, I believe, and we prayed all together, 40,000 people. That's a stadium's worth of people. As we've prayed that God would thwart the plans of evil men, he came through last night and he answered our prayer. And that's a very significant thing that I think we can't forget.
Chris Mitchell, CBN News, Jerusalem.
You know, I think there were people praying more than just that call on 40,000 with Chuck Holton, by the way. I think we were praying globally. The Twitter sphere just lit up. And it was interesting because even the Eiffel Tower was dressed in the colors of the Israeli flag. And Britain responded in supporting Israel on the drone attacks faster than the United States did. But it was also, by the way, important to see Saudi Arabia step up. And by the way, credit where credit is due, we have the Abrahamic Accords to thank for that, because a coalition was built among nations where a coalition did not exist before. And those coalition members, as a result of the Abrahamic Accord, were there to offer assistance to Israel. I also think there's something to be said about where Reserve Brigadier General Amir Avivi said he believes that without offensive military actions, Israel will merely, his word, normalize Iran's attacks. So what you heard, and again, I think you've understood if you've watched what's been going on, if you listen to our guests and our broadcast here, Israel will take counsel from anywhere and from anyone, but in the end, Israel will do what Israel feels right to defend itself. Remember, established as a nation in 1948, but established thousands and thousands of years ago as a nation as well, this is a nation that understands that the God who watches over Israel will never slumber or sleep. So they are always understanding that God is watching over Israel, but by the same token, they have to make very earthbound decisions about what they do. I think the observation that this is a proxy war with Iran is spot on. Hamas is Iran. Hezbollah is Iran. Yemen is Iran. And when you look, and by the conversation we had with Bill Gertz, by the way, remember that we have now found Chinese-made armory in Gaza as well. So will this foment into a regional war? Only God knows that. But in the meantime, you and I need to be praying for protection for innocent people and wisdom for those who are called to make decisions in a time of war. Very tense over there. By the way, our entire second hour will be devoted to us. If you can't listen live, listen online. Back after this. The Bible has the answers to questions being asked by the world, questions about abortion and heaven and even climate change. That's why I've chosen Seek as this month's truth tool. Discover how the Bible offers real word answers to real world questions. Ask for your copy of Seek when you give a gift of any amount to In the Market. Call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, or go to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. Well, I get to spend the rest of this hour with my daughter, which is always a delight. So I want to be very professional about this. Not only is she my daughter, which we're very proud, my firstborn, a lawyer just like her daddy, but she's a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation at the Meese Center there and a prolific author. And she's written quite a bit about what I think has been a tsunami of news stories responding to the issue of transgenderism. Let's just put it this way. In the United States, we are out of step with the rest of the world. And number two, this is a house of cards that is starting to collapse. Whatever political juggernaut has been pushing this forward, and I can't figure, I guess there's money there. Planned Parenthood could make money. The pharmaceutical companies are making money with these puberty blockers. I don't get what the teachers union gets out of this. And I don't get what they get out of lying to parents. And so you can come to school and we'll help you have a legal seminar to teach you how to change your name. We'll have a closet for clothes that you can change. We're going to do everything possible after a 10-minute conversation to get you to change who you think you are in your body. The rest of the world hit the pause button. At least the free world has hit the pause button on this, but not the United States. Well, what Sarah's been writing about is that there have been just an amazing number of reports out that really say, wait a minute, facts, as John Adams said, are stubborn things. There are a lot of facts out there that say it's not a request, it's a mandate that you hit the pause button. And we're going to start with a report that came out of the UK. Now, you remember what was going on there? They put the pause button on some time ago because they decided that, wait a minute, these kids were coming in, they were acting too fast, maybe they need to look a little deeper, maybe they needed to listen a little bit harder. And what they found was, these kids really have a cluster of diagnoses all swirling around the issue of mental health, and this whole gender dysphoria thing is one among many, but it isn't the driver. And oh, by the way, that lie that said if you don't let them change their body through surgery or drugs, they'll kill themselves? Well, the report now out of Finland says exactly the opposite. In fact, it becomes a deterrent to suicide to not immediately jump in and deal with this gender dysphoria. But I get ahead of myself, but I want to go back to the UK. And a Dr. Hilary Cass there put out a report that was eye-opening. Sarah, the warmest of welcomes. I want to start with the Cass review because this was extremely important. First of all, in a land where Britain's been making a lot of bizarre decisions, and to quote my friend David Robertson, Scotland has become the laughingstock of the world with its hate crimes legislation. They've been moving progressively in this area. So you've got Scotland now going after J.K. Rowling saying, you know, this is a hate crime. You could spend up to 7 years in prison and pay a fee. You've got England, south of the border of Scotland, saying, we're going to kind of slow this down. They're not interested in pronouns. They're interested in mental health. Talk to me about what the Cass report found.
Yeah, she was actually contracted through the National Health Service, which is obviously operating out of London. It's the entire health system within the UK, in 2019 to actually study individuals on a long-term basis to determine exactly what the effects were of these so-called gender-affirming medical interventions. Now, Dr. Cass is no hack. Let me tell you that she is the former president of the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health. She is brilliant, exceptionally well-researched, cited multiple times, really is somebody who came into this with no political ideology whatsoever, just wanted to get the data. And what she released just a few days ago led with the fact that the underlying medical evidence for gender treatments are remarkably weak. That is exactly the use that she included. She talked about the fact that the entire gender medicine industry is built on shaky foundations, and that early puberty blocking, the rationale remains entirely unclear with, and this is a quote, weak evidence regarding the impact on gender dysphoria, mental or psychosocial health. In other words, you are doing nothing to solve the problem you purportedly have. And what's more, 60% of the individuals who are actually showing up to the two gender clinics PS recently closed in England because of their malfeasance. These young people are showing up, 60% of them, with undiagnosed mental health disorders, and in some cases, developmental disorders like autism spectrum disorder. So it's not only not making things better, it's actually making things worse.
Wow. So first, I'm interested in the court of public opinion. You talked about the fact that, if I can use this phrase, she's got medical chops. She's not a fringe by any stretch of the imagination. She didn't download her medical degree. She's part of the Royal College. And when you get that imprimatur of approval, people pay attention. So how has her report been received, first and foremost, within the NHS in the UK?
Well, first of all, in the NHS, I think they sort of saw the writing on the wall. She released what was called the interim report in mid-2022, and it was very clear that based on 2 or 3 years of research so far, she was already trending in the direction of recognizing that these medical interventions don't solve anything, but they actually make things worse. It was filled with some very doubtful language on her part, but she continued to work for an additional 2 years to make sure that she had followed these 9,000 patients all the way through their adolescence, all the way into their early adulthood. She describes being stonewalled by many of the gender medicine practitioners in the UK who didn't want to have conversations with her. So I think this is really ripping the Band-Aid off a seething wound that the UK has been struggling with now for the better part of 10 years, because it really does once and for all cement the fact that these procedures are not only barbaric, they are life-altering, they are irreversible, and they're being prescribed for no reason whatsoever. They are, for many of these individuals, actually making the underlying mental health worse.
Worse. Oh, my word. You said a couple of important things just about how science works. Science is a methodology, right? It just says, oh, that's how that works. That's the way this goes. So, oh, that's how it works comes through in the fact that, A, this was a long-term study. B, it was a massive study if there were 9,000 patients. And C, it was longitudinal. So she just didn't sit down and write this over a weekend. She's been tracking this for a long period of time. Now, the fact that the people who get paid for handing out these puberty blockers or doing the surgery are silent, I hate to say it, but money doesn't talk, it screams. This is threatening their livelihood. When we come back, just talk to me now about the United States and numbers. The uptick, we've talked about this before as a social contagion, but the numbers are ludicrous. Anybody who doesn't think that there isn't an influence through social media, through educators who think that this is their personal agenda in life, etc. So are we going to respond now to the CAST report appropriately here in the United States? Because if we know we have a mental health issue in this country, and we do, particularly among our young people, are we going to make them better or are we going to make them worse? Back after this. Visiting with Sarah Parshall Perry. Yes, my daughter, in full disclosure, also senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, who's been writing quite a bit about some of these seminal changes going on the battlefield for our children. You know, I'm looking at a headline from a British publication that said this regarding the Hillary CAST report that went out. Why did it take so long? Parents, campaigners, and former child patients hail bombshell report that dismantles NHS's transgender treatment model, but claim we've known for years this is a population of vulnerable young people. And then someone who is a prolific reporter on NHS gender issues said that the report done by Dr. CAST was, quote, an incredibly thorough piece of work examining NAS gender services, including that society owed its author, Dr. Hillary CAST, a huge debt of gratitude. Wow. Now, the sex merchants might have a problem with this, Sarah, but it seems to me that people who care about other people, who care about the mental health of young people, have said, we just knew something wasn't right. I mean, in no other area of medicine could you walk in and be able to get put on a medicine within 10 minutes like that, that would radically change you and have, in some cases, irreversible effects. In fact, to that end, this is the part of the tsunami of information that's come out. There's also another new report that talks about the effects of these puberty blockers are, quote, devastating and in many cases, irreversible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, now what they're discovering is that these puberty blockers actually can lead to not only osteoporosis and not only infertility, but also in many cases, they're tracking them to liver cancer development.
Oh, no.
So these are really, they are so catastrophically bad. And remember, one of the number one drugs used in this gender medicine protocol is a drug called Lupron. And it is a drug that's used to chemically castrate sex offenders before they go into prison so they do not become sex offenders again. That is the kind of level of intervention we are talking about here. And I have to tell you, there are a number of individuals who have really come out ahead of the game on this, who from the beginning said the medicine industry is not doing its homework. This is happening too quickly. We need to follow the path of Western Europe. England, Finland, Sweden, to a certain extent, France, have all backed off their earlier affirm-only, affirm-often model. But now that the CAS report is fully published, my hope is that the entire industry here within the United States will begin to take a very hard look at what it is doing to these young people who are exceptionally vulnerable, who are vulnerable to social contagion, who are being proselytized on social media, where they see celebrities like Elliot Page, formerly Ellen Page, telling them to participate in surveys about how satisfied they are with their particular gender-affirming care, when in fact all of the data defies what we're hearing from the top levels of government to cultural elites, to celebrities, to even, and unfortunately in many cases, public school educators
yes.
who are taking it upon themselves to affirmatively groom these children into divergent gender identities. The new sort of set of research now is the proliferation of these school, what I call gender support plans or gender confidentiality plans. What we're seeing is that 10 million public school students in the country are in a school that has a gender support plan that explicitly removes parental involvement. It is absolutely shocking. So medicine is sort of beginning now, I think, to crack at its foundation. We know that 24 states already have bans in place for these particular medical interventions for minors under the age of 18. My colleague and I wrote a paper on how they are entirely constitutional. It's within a state's rights to legislate and protect vulnerable individuals, just like we have with child welfare laws. Mm-hmm. So now the next phase of this battle, I think, is going to be in the public education sphere, where we're dealing with these mini fiefdoms of sort of gender illiberality, and teachers and administrators are cutting parents out of the equation as they socially transition their minor children. It really is unconscionable.
It is. It's educational malpractice, and I think it's a form of child abuse. Let me just touch on Hillary Cass one more time, and then I do. You took me where I wanted to go, which is right here in our own backyard in the United States. So this report, by the way, is 388 pages long. You can find it if you wanted to look online. You can read the whole thing. So this is a massive report. So you cannot say methodology was bad, variables were not right, or you had too many. I mean, it is past scientific scrutiny in terms of research. And so it is causing a kind of revolution within the medical community. Now, obviously, the change agents, the people who profit from this, are going to have a problem, hence the pushback from that community in the UK. But that does take me to the United States. What is it about Sweden and Finland and France and the UK and other countries that get it? Well, we don't get it in the United States. I mean, the president addressed this in the State of the Union saying, we see you and I want you to help me pass the Equality Act. So what are we doing wrong? And I want to get to the education on that. Those educators, not all of them, but that's my background, by the way. I am the daughter of a teacher as well. So teaching runs deep in my blood. But there are, nonetheless, there are bad apples in every profession, and there are some bad apples in teaching who have decided that this idea of fomenting and pursuing this agenda about your definition sexually is more important than teaching them state capitals. So what I want to get explore and get from you, Sarah, is some input on why the United States is resistant Where is the resistance coming from? And how do you crack the teachers' union? Because so often the average public school teacher doesn't have a choice. This is top down and the union is forcing them to do this. And then you get the hand in a glove fit between the union and what some radical members of the state legislature want when they're insisting that this be done. And I also want to touch on the idea that now you've got medical information that this is harmful, and yet you've got states like California that are proposing that if you don't do it, if you don't affirm, if you don't acknowledge, that's child abuse. Back after this. Going through life with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other is essential for each of us on our walk with Christ. And that's what we do on In the Market. We examine culture, interpret the headlines, and look at the news from a biblical perspective. When you become a partial partner, you're directly responsible for putting this program on the air, reaching men and women across America with the practical application of God's Word. Become a partial partner today by calling 877-JANET-58 or go to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. Sarah Parshall Perry is with a senior legal fellow at America's preeminent think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and she's been writing quite a bit because so much has been happening on the front of this transgenderism, which is tied into politics and money, and sometimes it's a wanton abandonment of sound medicine. Well, thanks be to God for the CAS review, this pediatrician, this preeminent pediatrician in the UK who did a longitudinal study and found out that they have just been making some horrible mistakes. In fact, she made this quote: "The reality is that we have no good evidence on the long-term outcomes of intervention to manage gender-related distress." And so people are now believing that the NHS has for too long given vulnerable children harmful treatments for which there was no evidence-based need. And in fact, what we're saying is that this is simply indicative of something even more problematic, which is a single or a cluster of mental health issues that need to be addressed. And in fact, the amputations, the puberty blockers, the put on your different clothes, change your pronouns, every single one of those serves to actually harm, not help the child. Now I give you the United States of America. Sarah, where is the pushback coming in the United States? Because surely we have bright people in this country. And when you look at a person at a country that is run very much in a similar sort of self-governance that we have, and they're putting out these kinds of reports, and countries like France and Sweden and the UK are all saying, no. Do we not have enough people who care, who are objective scientists, who need to follow where the evidence leads, not be a part of a political agenda and bend and twist the facts to fit that agenda? Are we going to start to see a pushback in the medical community first? Let me start there.
Well, we've got a big problem on our hands, which is that some of the major sort of accrediting and affirming organizations are highly politicized. The American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Endocrine Society are all heavily funded by the left. They are also very heavily politicized. In fact, not surprisingly, the Human Rights Campaign, which is a very staunch, hard left LGBTQIA advocacy center, created something called the Equity Index to determine which hospitals in the country were all the most welcoming, which had the sort of greatest level of diversity, especially so for LGBTQ populations. Well, not surprisingly, the study was underwritten by Pfizer Pharmaceutical, who makes some of the exact chemicals. Yes, that's exactly it, that these young people are being given. So there is so much money. You are so right in that money doesn't just talk, it screams, and it especially screams within the gender medicine industry. This is a $3 billion a year industry. By the end of next year, they're estimating it's going to be a $10 billion a year industry. But what we've seen now is an increasing measure, sort of the mask torn off. In fact, the leak of what's known as the files from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health to Michael Schellenberger, an investigative reporter, revealed on closed-circuit camera, where these individuals did not believe that what they were saying was actually ever going to be made public. They talked about the fact they cannot get meaningful consent for minor children, because children don't have a concept of not being able to, for example, carry a child or nurse a baby or being utterly infertile or having sexual dysfunction or an increased risk of cancer. You can't tell a 15-year-old that, and I know because I have one. They don't have any concept of what the future is going to look like for them when they are dealing with the ups and downs of puberty. So these individuals, these doctors who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on these very expensive surgeries and chemical interventions are not getting consent from these children, and in many respects are actually working to cut the parents out of the equation when the parents seem unsupportive. It is absolutely jaw-dropping. Now, we have other organizations like the American College of Pediatricians, which is not politicized, which has always been very middle of the road. They actually did a review of more than 60 studies on mental health in the United States in adolescents with gender dysphoria, and they concluded, just as Hillary Cass did, that gender-affirming care has no demonstrable long-term benefit on a patient's psychological well-being. 60 studies over the period of 15 years. It really does indicate that there are right-thinking individuals, but there are louder, better funded, and more visible organizations against which those of us who are critical of gender medicine and this sudden, precipitous rise in individuals who are identifying as transgender really needs to be addressed. Talking about the truth, identifying the truth, pointing to the statistics, that isn't hate speech. It's not transphobic. It is something that must be done in the interest of truth, common sense, the safety and protection of these children, and in recognition of the fact that God creates us perfectly male and female. No one is born in the wrong body.
Yeah. Amen and amen. So we've talked about the medical community and clearly its connection to the pharmaceutical community. And that is, if that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is. But now let's go to the education world. And it's tied back to governors who are now fomenting the idea that if, and I give you the state of Indiana, I'm still gobsmacked about that case in Indiana where that young man living in his parents' home was not going to be affirmed by his parents. They were falsely accused first by Child Protective Services in that state of child abuse. Those charges were later taken away, but they still decided it wasn't in the best interest of the child to not have his new identity affirmed by the parents. They put him in foster care until he aged out. And then he was given, while he was in foster care, a couple hours a week with his parents. So it completely ruined the dynamic between the parent and the child. I don't get it. These are clearly people, one would presume, that they investigate, they're intellectually curious, they're going to see what all of the manuals have to say, what the periodicals, the magazines, the trends are saying, and yet they are purposely turning a blind eye and a deaf ear that, wait, there's something deeper here, deeper to the point where we don't care about the child's mental health. In fact, we're going to turn this around and we're going to boomerang against the parents. And if you don't support what we, the teachers, the state demand, you, parent, are going to be charged with child abuse. That's the ultimate bomber, is it not? I mean, it's stunning to me.
It's the weaponization now of so many aspects of the American culture, right? So we're not just seeing the gender identity issues sort of foment and proliferate within medicine, and we're not just seeing it within education. Obviously, we've talked about men and women in sports and how now women have to compete on roster slots against biological males, thanks to what we're seeing coming from the federal government and their rule on Title IX, which is a less something significant happens, it's going to be effective for every school in the country starting in September. We're now also seeing it within the relationship between parents and children in the concept of, for example, custody and child welfare laws. And once again, we see these state law judges making determinations that not affirming a child's delusion is actually somehow abusive. And to have gotten to the point where these parents in Indiana, who were already determined, I might add, to be fit parents by the court, but then to still lose custody of their child is absolutely mind-boggling. It's not the first case we're going to see like this. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more cases like this popping up across the country, thanks to, for example, laws in states like Washington, Oregon, and California, as well as Michigan, that now determine their states are sanctuary states for runaway adolescents who want to get gender-affirming care without their parental involvement. So they actually now not only affirmatively bring these kids into the state, shield their whereabouts from their parents, but then provide for no cost to them any of the gender-related modification treatments that they actually want. Within the concept of what our children are learning in the classroom, it's now not just about whether or not the curriculum includes information about same-sex marriage or gender identitarianism. It goes precisely to the nature of the formation of a child's own identity themselves. Schools create gender support plans. They issue guidelines. The guidelines are published throughout the entire school district. In my home state of Maryland, for example, there is a case that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, came out of the Fourth Circuit for Montgomery County, Maryland, public schools, because three sets of parents challenged the guidelines that were hiding gender identity information from them actively. That is not only unconstitutional, it breaks down the entire structure of what an educational institution is supposed to do, regardless of what we're hearing from the commander-in-chief about the fact that these are, quote, all our children. I have the stretch marks to prove that, no, in fact, I have three of them that are solely under my discretionary authority. These schools are of the mind, incorrectly, that they are the ones who know best for children when the child is in an experimental phase of developing his or her own self-identity. I cannot think for a moment that there is a more ripe situation for a parent to be involved in than when a child believes that they might be born in the wrong body. So we're seeing these now, and there is one, like I said, pending on a petition for cert at the Supreme Court, actually proliferating across the country in no fewer than five federal appellate circuits.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. You touched on Title IX. I want to go back to that because we have had multiple conversations about the comment period, what this administration might do to jerry-rig Title IX going in the future to, again, accommodate this social contagion. I want to get an update on what's going on. Sarah Parshall Perry is with us. I've got a great article she's written linked on our information page. Check it out. She is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and we'll continue right after this. We're visiting with Sarah Parshall Perry, who is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and we're talking about this, well, the intersection of law and medicine and education when it comes to our children, their mental health, and this new social contagion about gender dysphoria in the break. And all of my pages are absolutely lighting up, Sarah. Apparently, the Supreme Court has just ruled that Idaho can enforce a law banning sex changes for kids. The ruling allows Idaho to enforce a law that subjects doctors up to 10 years in prison if they provide hormones, puberty blockers, or do sex change surgeries on minors. That is a huge win. Now, this just broke, but why do you think the court came down on the side of Idaho? Was this, did they just take the merits, push it aside, and look at it strictly as a state's rights issue?
Well, it's very possible that that's exactly what happened, because there are actually two other cases pending right now, three, pending at the Supreme Court on the constitutionality of these state gender medicine bans, two coming out of Tennessee and one coming out of Kentucky. Now, here's what's important about that. In the Tennessee case, the United States has cross-petitioned, meaning the Department of Justice has come out and said the federal government has a stake in this outcome. The reason that's important is because frequently that will play into the justice's determination as to whether or not to grant review. If the federal government has said we are taking a position on this, then it's very likely that the Supreme Court will be forced to ultimately dispose of the issue by taking it head on. Now, It could very well be a procedural dismissal at this point and allowing the law to go forward in Idaho because they understand there are three other cases they're going to have to address on the merits. But, yes, it is very possible that this was an emergency injunction that was filed, one of the many that have been filed this exact term. And rather than issuing a full-scale opinion on this, they took it on what's called the shadow docket, made a brief determination about the fact that there was no pressing injury to actually argue for suspension of the law and let the law go into effect while it's being litigated in lower federal court. That still leaves the three that are pending on a cert petition out of Kentucky and two out of Tennessee.
Wow. So Idaho now is one of more than 20 states that have taken this same position. So that's good news. Now, what happens if we see a majority of states take this position and yet the federal government has a decidedly different take? There's an interesting tension. How will that be resolved?
Well, it's very interesting because it's going to, unfortunately, probably end back up at the Supreme Court. And ultimately, that's what's happened here. In the case coming out of Tennessee, the case is called L.W. versus Scrimeti, and the United States has filed its own lawsuit, United States versus Scrimeti, and they're saying, basically, listen, this gender-affirming care is medically necessary, and the science supports it, both of which, by the way, based on the first 45 minutes of the show, we know are lies.
Right.
They're actually telling the Supreme Court, listen, this is where we're coming down on this, so it is already sort of a clash of the titans. Does the federal government's interpretation of a law trump state law democratically enacted within its own constitutional authority? States are the ones properly under the 10th Amendment to deal with medical issues, including medical licensing, medical care. We've seen it now post the Dobbs versus Jackson decision, many abortion laws coming out in the states where it's either more restricted or it's more permissive. But this is really the question of whose authority triumphs on a sort of very novel, evolving area of scientific analysis that's now being questioned in greater measure. Do states have a constitutional interest in protecting vulnerable kids? They do. And I've written a paper on it. We've examined all of the case law, and I'm very hopeful that the three cases right now pending on a petition for review will be taken up, consolidated, and we can finally get clarity in the fact that states are doing exactly what the Constitution permits.
So can I just wax philosophical for a minute? You know, this is the conundrum for the court, Sarah, because if you listen to the oral arguments on the FDA and the abortion pill, you know, you heard the argument, well, we want to leave the agencies to make their own decisions and we're not a medical entity and, you know, we don't want to blah, blah, blah. You heard that whole path. But yet you're dealing with another medical issue with trans. And I understand based on the conversation we just had about the circumnavigation, the question of whether this was done on the merits or procedural, really it was the transcendence of states' rights versus the federal government. Whether they want to or not, so many of the issues that they end up dealing with have some medical component to them. That's not a disqualifier for them to take the case, is there?
No, not at all. In fact, it's very interesting because the fact that there is sort of underlying medical research involved in this will very likely play into some of these decisions. It did at the appellate court level. In fact, many of these courts have said, specifically the Sixth Circuit in the L.W. versus Scrimeti case, listen, there's no consensus on this. We're seeing evolving data. Certain organizations are pushing it. Certain organizations are opposing it. We've got people doing research indicating this isn't helpful or beneficial. And, P.S., the Supreme Court's recognized time and again, children have diminished capacity to recognize the consequences of their behavior, shock and awe. And with three teenagers, I can tell you they have diminished capacity to recognize the consequences of their behavior. So it's going to be an issue that will certainly play in, but it's not the definitive issue. It's whether or not the state has a power, has the ability to do this, when obviously we know that these individuals are certainly vulnerable, as we can tell from social contagion and from sort of the precipitous rise in the number of kids who identify as transgender, which now in the United States is as high as over 300,000 kids.
Wow. Wow. I started it and I don't want to not finish it, but just give me a thumbnail of what's going on with Title IX at this point.
Well, Title IX has just left the Office of Management and Budget, which is the White House, for its final review, which means any day now we could see this published in the Federal Register. Congress has 60 days to vote it up or down, and then it's cemented for the next coming school year.
Wow. Wow, Sarah, we covered a lot. The truth be told, there is a whole lot more we could continue to cover. Thank you so much for the excellent work that you do at the Heritage Foundation, and thank you for taking these sometimes challenging and often esoteric legal issues and putting them just on terra firma in common parlance for us to understand. And to that end, I do want to draw people to our information page where I've linked an article that you wrote. In the market with JanetParshall.org, after the summation of each hour, you see a red box that says Program Details and Audio. Click that on. It'll take you over to the information page. And on the right-hand side is a piece that Sarah wrote for the Daily Signal that really and truly gets into a deeper conversation about the Hillary Cass review. And it's well worth your time. The mandate from Scripture is to look well to the ways of your household. And in this era in which we find ourselves in a post-truth world, that means knowing where this issue shows up, how it shows up, and how best you can fight for your family. What you just heard with Sarah, I think, will be a weapon in your arsenal, and I hope you'll use it. Thanks so much, Sarah. Thank you, friends. We'll see you next time on In the Market with Janet Parshall.